It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. In just a minute, we'll take a look at the changing hemp industry in the United States. Our guest says we're on the verge of an agricultural revolution.
First, this week is Screen-Free Week, according to the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. It's an effort to get kids and families to take time off from TV and computers and tablets and smartphones, except for what's needed for school or work.
Is your family doing this, or how do you control screen time in your household? Ironically, I'll ask you to tweet it, tweet what you do to us, or post a message on the Central Time Facebook page. If you tweet us, we're at Central Time WPR, or if you want to keep yourself honest, write us a letter at Central Time, Wisconsin Public Radio, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. And speaking of irony, we've got five screens that we can see on just on our side of the booth alone. Are you doing the Screen-Free Week?
You know, we are doing Screen-Free Week, and we're in day two of it. It started yesterday. We forgot, actually, initially in the morning, and then had to pull the brakes on it, and the kids weren't happy about that. But now that we're into it, it's actually going pretty well.
No withdrawal symptoms?
I don't know. There might be some withdrawal symptoms, but I think overall, no one's hostile. No one's threatened to leave the family, and things are kind of peaceful.
We haven't done it. We're just sticking with our standard limits on screen time. No more than 6 hours a day per kid. Okay, a little less than that.
You're such good parents.
We try.
Well, now, aside from setting away high-tech products, we're bringing back some older technology. At least thinking about that in our next piece. Around the time of World War II, Wisconsin was one of the leading hemp-producing states in the country, and the federal government was encouraging farmers to produce more, as in this USDA public service announcement.
With Philippine and East Indian sources of hemp in the hands of the Japanese, and shipment of jute from India curtailed, American hemp must meet the needs of our Army and Navy, as well as of our industries. In 1942, patriotic farmers, at the government's request, planted 36,000 acres of seed hemp, an increase of several thousand percent. The goal for 1943 is 50,000 acres of seed hemp.
The crop was used primarily to make ropes and fabric, but that changed after the war as industrial hemp was banned by the federal government because of its relationship to marijuana.
The tides may be turning again, though, this time in hemp's favor. The new farm bill signed earlier this year makes it possible for states to legalize industrial hemp, and now some are calling on Wisconsin's lawmakers to legalize it. In light of recent changes, our next guest calls hemp the next agricultural revolution in the United States. Doug Fine is a self-described comedic investigative journalist. He's a best-selling author. His new book is called Hemp Bound. Doug, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, take us through a little of the history. We heard hemp was part of the war effort in World War II. Why was growing hemp, though, outlawed in the U.S.?
It was almost a typo. In the same, actually, 1937 Marijuana Stamp Act that was intended to banish, it really started sort of this 77 years of reefer madness. Hemp sort of got lumped in there as all versions of the cannabis plant were banned, which makes the 1942 propaganda film that sounded like Your Roommate with the Lava Lamp all the more amazing, because it was done after Prohibition had started, and yet it took until this year for hemp to be re-legalized via the Farm Bill.
You know, I'll say in my head, hemp and marijuana can be almost synonymous. Separate them out. What's the difference between hemp on one hand, marijuana on the other?
In the countries that are utilizing the fast-growing industrial cannabis or hemp economy, namely just about everywhere from Africa to Canada except here, and thankfully that's changing too, the definition is hemp is anything that, any variety of the cannabis plant that has 0.3% THC or less, which is the active ingredient, the psychoactive ingredient in cannabis. So effectively non-psychoactive, a pure agricultural product. And there is no way to confuse the two types of plant. There's a number of reasons there's no way to confuse them, but the most important reason is psychoactive cannabis is cultivated only the females, and the flowers are the market. Industrial cannabis or hemp is grown on vast, vast tracts, and the pollen from the male hemp plants would immediately create seeds and ruin a very, very expensive prima donna plant that's for, let's say, medicinal cannabis or social cannabis. So they can't even be grown within several miles of each other. And the proof's in the pudding. In Canada's 15-year modern industry, which is going to broach $1 billion this year, which is why farmers are so excited to get back on it, by the way. It's the bottom line reasons. They have had zero cases of confusion, and they used their former version of the DEA to inspect. So there's no way to confuse it.
So what do we do with industrial hemp?
Oh, gosh, where to begin? So let's start with, again, the bottom line. The Canadians are growing almost exclusively for seed oil. So and they're making, by the way, profit per acre, $300 per acre, which has a lot of non-liberals in North Dakota jumping up and down like, again, your roommate with the lava lamp, 10 times more than what they might be making on the standard sort of GMO corn, wheat, soy cycle. So the seed oil is where the money is, and therefore all the rest of the applications that I love to preach about can tag along. So thank you for the high prices. And that's our demand for the seed oil. It's a nutritive superfood. I went to look at university studies about this, and it's the real deal, omega balanced and easily replicable, and it'll be inexpensive when it is domestic. I pay a lot for it in my morning shake because it's Canadian. So seed oil, first and foremost.
All right, we'll get into some of the other applications. You list a lot in your book, but I want to get into the changing politics. You've mentioned the roommate with the lava lamp. There's an image of who is promoting hemp. Maybe some people on the political fringe would introduce symbolic legislation. Who is in the political world supporting hemp to the extent that the federal government is letting states go ahead and legalize it if they want?
I still can't believe that I am hearing these words come out of my mouth. In Hempbound, in the second paragraph, I said an astonishing no-brainer is happening. Hemp is coming back, and that is because of, in this era, almost incomprehensible bipartisan agreement on an issue. I mean, it reflects the fact that 80% of Americans support hemp, but just to give the biggie, Republican Senator Mitch McConnell from Kentucky is one of, not just a supporter, but one of the active players behind hemp's return in last year's farm bill and a provision put forth by Colorado Congressman Jared Polis, who's a Democrat. Bipartisan support, and not only just supporting it, but some of these folks on both sides of the aisle are really leaning on regulatory agencies like the DEA to allow the import of viable seed, which would have been seized prior to this past February, but all that changed with the Farm Bill.
And where, supposing hemp were legalized, where would be some of the prime locations that might be the new hemp valleys of the world? Kentucky, obviously, Mitch McConnell's interested because it might be a profitable thing in his state. Where else?
Hemp cultivars, as the varieties are known on the hemp side of the cannabis plant, hemp cultivars are at this point inured to, if not native to, every place except Antarctica. So just about any climate can successfully cultivate hemp for seed oil and fiber, and one that I think is really important, energy. So if I were speaking to a prospective Wisconsin farmer or processor or investor, I would say look for a place that has similar climate, not just moisture and elevation, but phytol period. In some studies, it's been found that the rate of daylight is really important. And look for a place on the map that cultivates hemp at that sort of in that sort of climate, and start trying to get it imported. That's the hardest part of jumpstarting this industry. There's profits from season one, but getting the seeds in here and in the ground is the hard part.
And you highlight some farmers and others around the country trying to lead the way on this. Who are going to be the first big producers of hemp as states legalize it?
I think it's going to rapidly grow on multiple fronts. But Colorado in the U.S. has a head start. Now it's going on a two-year head start. They're starting their second commercial season. Last year it was a handful of farmers, and one of them's name was Ryan Laughlin. And it was one of the most fun parts of researching about hemp was mid-August last year, going with my family to this extremely conservative part of eastern Colorado, and meeting with this guy who's putting his federally subsidized farm at risk, planting 60 acres of hemp, and he had a lot of explicit reasons for doing it. One was getting that seed stock going. It's gone, and now Colorado has 1 year head start on that. But another reason was seeing if your roommate with the lava lamp was right in some of hemp's qualities, and the one that they were really looking at in that struggling, drying Oglala Reservoir out there in the Eastern Plains what is the water demand of the hemp plant? And what Ryan found is half of the previous year's wheat crop. Huge news to his neighbors, who might be able to dry land crops, start to rebuild the soil. We haven't even gotten into hemp spider remediation or soil healing quality. So it really, the pipe dream of a hamster actually might be coming true in real life.
We're talking to Doug Fine. He's the author of the new book, Hempbound, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Next Agricultural Revolution. And we'd like to hear from you. Wisconsin used to be a big producer of hemp in the United States. With a new farm bill, it's up to the state legislature whether Wisconsinites could produce it again. Do you think hemp should be legalized and grown, produced here in Wisconsin? What do you see as the advantage? Do you see a downside? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post over at the Central Time Facebook page. We'll take your calls in a few moments after this look at the headlines with Noah Ovshinsky.
For the first time, the Vatican is providing a breakdown of how it handled more than 3,400 cases of abuse that were reported to the church since 2004. It says during that time, it defrocked 848 priests who raped or molested children. More than 2,500 priests were sanctioned with lesser penalties. Police in California plan to interview the teenager who survived while stowed away in the wheel well of a jetliner as it crossed the Pacific Ocean 2 weeks ago. The 15-year-old Somali immigrant flew back to California over the weekend. And Wisconsin farmers can expect to see more crops damaged by extreme weather, and residents will see the Great Lakes shrink, forests recede, and higher air conditioning bills as a result of climate change. Those are the highlights from a report the Obama administration released today. Scientists say Wisconsin has been warming since at least 1950, with longer growing seasons that have benefited some farmers, but those benefits are likely to be offset by damage from floods, drought, and other extreme weather. For Central Time, I'm Noah Ovshinsky.
I'm Deborah from Madison, and I donated my 1997 Mercury Sable to Wisconsin Public Radio. And Mark really handled the donation process. I did the sign-up online. It was very simple.
My job was the disposing of the car, being there when the fella showed up with the flatbed.
He actually got to take a picture at the end, wave goodbye to the car. I was at work when this all happened.
You know, it was a faithful car.
It has gone on to a better place, yes, for a good reason.
Donate your car through CarTalk's vehicle donation program.
Go to WPR.org.
Support for WPR comes from the Florentine Opera, presenting La Bohème. The opera features a tale of tragic romance in 19th century Paris. May 9th and 11th at the Marcus Center. More at florentineopera.org. Support also comes from Needed Relief Day Spa and Wellness, a spa within the city. With Prairie Views, Needed Relief is dedicated to providing a relaxing atmosphere. Gift cards available at Needed Relief in Fitchburg and online at neededreliefdayspa.com.
This is Central Time with Rob and Veronica. We're back with Doug Fine, author of Hempbound, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Next Agricultural Revolution. You can join the conversation about the impending legalization of hemp production around in states around the country, maybe here in Wisconsin. Would you like to see it legalized? What do you see as the benefits? What would be the downside? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll get your calls in just a moment. But Doug, we talked a little bit about the uses of hemp earlier. Wanted to get more into that. Saw a video where you were showing off some of your clothing made of hemp. What would be the advantages of hemp fabric compared to, you know, cotton and the other standbys?
In my family, hemp simply went out in the marketplace. We were cloth diapering two kids at once. So in that cycle, which, you know, a certain percentage of listeners right now are nodding in sympathy, it's brutal, especially if you're line drying and the cotton disintegrated and the hemp held up. There are a lot of other examples of that. I find it to be really effective work clothing. Holds up well to travel. A Stanford-led study in Anatolia region of Turkey just turned up perfectly preserved hemp clothing in a 9,000-year-old tomb. So it's, you know, it's the real deal. China's moving so fast to it, though, because cotton contributes 30% of the world's pesticides. And they're seeing diminished returns, and they need an alternative. So that's the reason why China's pushing hemp so fast. And they're really ahead. I think that even though hemp is in the fiber of BMWs and Mercedes now, that's European know-how. I visited the factory there and wrote about that. We can catch up if somebody really wants to do it. The nanotechnology, the 3D plastics, there's a lot of great hemp applications. I got to kick the hood of a hemp tractor in Canada. So, but I think the first big killer app for the fiber side. For the American market, is likely to be in construction. Very briefly, hempcrete is very easy to do. You just chop up the fiber and mix it with lime, and it creates an insulating material that has a higher R value than the fiberglass insulation we use today.
We'll get to our callers now. We've got Brett on the line in Waukesha. Brett, hi, you're on the air.
A great show. Thanks, Noah. Great show. This is State Representative Brett Holtze calling. I'm running for governor, and I definitely support industrial hemp. It just makes sense for our families, our farmers. One of the things you didn't point out is hemp is also a great wildlife food for birds. It used to grow on our farm down in Oklahoma, and while I didn't smoke any myself, my brother said he didn't get any excitement from it. So.
Brett Tulsey, thanks for the call. Making the case there, and good for wildlife, he says too, Doug.
Yeah, and livestock. An old-time rancher lady told me that in Nebraska she planted her daddy planted hemp along the irrigation ditches, and it's really unique. You'd think that there was some magical thing about this plant until you kind of look at it like Michael Pollan, the author, who says we've co-evolved with the plant. We've bred it for the qualities we like, and one of the amazing qualities of hemp is in an annual and very quick growing season, in fact, it will grow foot-long taproots, which is any agronomist will know is very important for soil health, but it also is fantastic for erosion control. So no matter how much water came through those irrigation ditches, their crops didn't get flooded. And then they put the cattle on it in the fall, and they loved the high-protein treat. I'm looking at my own goats right now, by the way, and they can't wait till I'm feeding them hemp seed cake.
Brett, thanks for the call. Go to Kyle now in Milwaukee. Kyle, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to say, second, everything that's being said is you can make excellent paper that lasts an extremely long time for a lot less acreage. You're not destroying, long-term wildlife and trees. It also makes an excellent oil, which from what I have read can actually be better than fossil oil for lubrication. And it makes excellent rope. Our Constitution was written on it. Our founding forefathers said any patriot would plant as much of it as possible. Of all of its uses.
All right, Kyle, thanks for the call. Doug, that reminds me, one other thing you say can be used for is not just oil for lubrication, but actually as fuel.
Yes, I'm so glad you mentioned it because it's the final piece of the picture, Rob. As far as going from the old to the new, one other traditional use I just wanted to throw in there was the canvas on the wagons that settled Wisconsin where hemp canvas. So as well as the webbing in the parachute that saved George Bush Sr.'s life during his bailout in World War II. So I'm moving on to the app that really, as a father, has me the most excited. I kind of live in a perpetual screen-free week here in the middle of nowhere in New Mexico and drive on vegetable oil and get outsmarted by goats. So I'm really into the sustainability mode. And I noticed that biomass, Germany's really, leading this kind of alternative energy revolution on the national level, and that they're really using a lot of this biomass combustion technique, anaerobic carbon-friendly, called gasification. They're small units, not very expensive. I found out subsequently that the U.S. Army is buying units of these gasification furnaces, and they basically, at very high heat in an anaerobic process, combust any kind of farm waste. And then what I look at as the upside of this ridiculous hemp prohibition, 77-year-long prohibition, is that now we can look around the world and see, okay, Canada's making money on the seed oil. China knows how to do the textiles. Europe's got the high-end sort of space-age use for the bass fibers, the high-end fibers. And then what do we do with the stalks that are left after these processes, the bark, essentially? In Canada today, they just burn them in the field. It's not what to do with it. When I asked why, a seed oil mogul up there told me, well, because fossil fuel prices are still too low. Just, wait. So I say let's not wait. Let's free ourselves from fossil fuels in every first-generation hemp processing facility. Have a seed oil processing unit, which is not very doesn't require a lot of space, even to process a lot of oil, just pressing seeds like any other seed crop. Some sort of fiber facility, construction, whatever it is. And a third facility that will implement these gasification units, the smallest of them are the size of like a large outhouse, and they can either feed a community-wide grid or just be part of an individual, locations providing its own sort of grid energy. The other thing I want to say about that is that there's a plan in Kentucky today, a company called Patriot Biofuels, again, a very non-liberal utility CEO, buying up land on damaged tobacco and coal farms, coal mining areas, to plant hemp, which grows well in marginal soils, and then harvest it for use in this kind of gasification product. That's like the plan is underway for this to happen.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Melissa on the line in Eau Claire. Melissa, hi.
Hi. I fully support the legislation, and I guess I'm confused why there's so much controversy, because my understanding is there's no THC, you know, in hemp as it is in marijuana. So I wonder if you kind of clear that up for me, because I'm really confused about that.
So why still a controversy? You did mention that there's little or no THC in industrial hemp, Doug.
There's also little or no controversy. Honestly, it will seem incredible to those who study history that there was even a debate. But this time the wall came down and the law changed in this year's Farm Bill. It only allowed research in universities, cultivar research, that type of thing, university-connected research, to rebuild the seed stock. But there is now today an S-359 in the U.S. Senate, which would fully remove cannabis with negligible THC from the Controlled Substances Act and allow states in the USDA to regulate it like any other crop, which is, of course, a big no-brainer. But hopefully that will go through this year. Colorado is not waiting. I was there on the first day, their state agriculture department started issuing or accepting applications for full commercial hemp cultivation in the Rocky Mountain state, and it's happening. There's 100 farmers that have applied and 1,300 acres being cultivated, a small fraction of the exponential growth we're going to see nationwide over these next few years. But again, it gives Colorado this two-year head start.
We'll leave it there. Doug, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Doug Fine. His new book is Hemp Bound, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Next Agricultural Revolution. We've been talking to him about changing laws, apparently leading the way toward legal industrial hemp production in states around the United States. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We begin with the news that 8 girls were abducted last night in northeastern Nigeria. This comes after the kidnapping of more than 200 other schoolgirls last month by the Islamic militant group Boko Haram. Now the group is threatening to sell the girls, quote, on the market.
The latest abductions comes as Nigeria prepares to host the World Economic Forum on Africa. And with increasing attention on the country, there is growing pressure to locate and rescue the girls, as well as crack down on Boko Haram's campaign of violence.
Joining us now is Lauren Sapina. She's the Senior Vice President of Women Thrive Worldwide. She's also served as head of the White House's Office of Women's Initiatives and Outreach during the Clinton administration. Lauren, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you.
So what do we know so far about these abductions? There's still some mystery as to just where these girls are, right?
Right. There's a lot of mystery. I mean, this is the original abductions of almost 300 girls happened on April 14th. So we are 3 weeks later, and we still don't know where they are. I mean, every day, every minute that goes by, the group that abducted them is a group called Boko Haram. And that means in the local language, it literally translates into Western education is a sin. They have said, this group, Boko Haram, has said, we are going to sell these girls into slavery for as little as $12 apiece. And this is just an outrage, and that so much time can go by and we can't locate them, we're not getting answers. It should be an international outcry.
And their opposition, Boko Haram's opposition to education, is especially targeted at girls. They specifically don't want girls receiving education.
Yes. I mean, they don't want any Western education, but specifically educating girls. Boko Haram operates in northern Nigeria. They operate in Cameroon, in Niger. Right now in Niger, there are 10.5 million youth that are not going to school. So when you take an abduction of 300 schoolgirls, and these are girls between the ages of 14 and 18 years old, who merely went to school one day and they're abducted, that number of 10.5 million kids out of school is only going to rise. It strikes fear in any parent to even send their child to school.
And the Nigerian government has gotten a lot of criticism internationally and domestically, protests, descriptions as a feeble and ineffective response. Is the country taking these abductions, is the government of Nigeria taking these abductions seriously?
I don't believe so at all. Of course not. If 300 girls can go missing and we can't, and the threat of selling them into slavery, we even heard there were reports that a few of them had died. No, unless they can locate those children, they are not doing everything they can. That is not being taken seriously enough. And that is why Women Thrive started a petition to really to create more of an outcry, to try to get both the U.S. government and the Nigerian government to act.
Well, let's bring things home. What has the U.S. response been here?
Well, Secretary Kerry made a statement on Saturday saying they would do everything they can. I understand that they are going to send special forces in. But, you know, the World Economic Forum is going to be held starting tomorrow. So these are world leaders that are going to be going there. The Nigerian government needs to respond. They need to find these girls. They need to protect the girls that are there. Unfortunately, this is something that happens around the world every day. It may not happen in the numbers of 300, but girls and women are abducted and sold into slavery. And this is a human rights issue. It is something that we need to take notice of. It is something we need to do something about.
And you say that this isn't just an isolated incident. This is part of a wider pattern of abuse of girls and women around the world. What do you want to see from the international community, not just on what's going on in Nigeria, but on these issues more broadly?
Well, we want it to be a human right that girls can receive an education. It has been proven time and time again that when girls get an education, they can lead more independent, more economical, more free lives. Their communities are lifted out of poverty. They are lifted out of poverty. Their countries are lifted out of poverty. This is all for an education. I mean, we saw this with Malala in her fight for an education. We see these extremist groups like Boko Haram, like the Taliban, just afraid of girls gaining an education and doing anything they can to stop it.
What's behind that, do you think, this opposition to girls getting an education around the world?
A lot of it is a fear of what happens when those girls get an education and they do lead these independent lives. A lot of it is a cultural fear. It is, you know, like I mentioned, Boko Haram translates to Western education is a sin. It is the idea that we need to keep girls and women from gaining any kind of independence. We want to keep them enslaved. We don't want them to have human rights. And unfortunately, when 3 weeks can go by and the international community isn't in an uproar about 300 girls missing, we continue that process of saying women and girls are not important.
This, as you mentioned, happened 3 weeks ago in Nigeria, just starting to get more media attention here in the United States, our first time, I'll say, talking about it on this show as well. Why has this been such a slow burn? Why have we in the U.S. media been slow to jump on this?
Well, that's a good question. I can't really speculate why people haven't. I have to say Women Thrive was one of the first out in front gaining this trying to get media attention around it. We heard about this because one of our global partners, a young woman by the name of Ojanwa Miachi, she's a 22-year-old Nigerian education advocate, and we've worked with her for a while. She reached out to us and said, you know, this happened. Please help. And this is what we could do to help. Unfortunately, women and girls still don't get the notice that they should, and the abduction of 300 girls from Nigeria who still can't be located has not gotten the international attention, both on media, both with governments, and both with relief. They haven't received the attention they should have.
Is part of the problem that women's issues are maybe seen as a separate part of foreign policy and foreign aid? We have, you know, a peace over here and hunger over here and justice over here, and maybe women's issues are not front and center in all of those?
Well, absolutely. It should be much higher on the scale. I believe everybody quotes Hillary Clinton when she said, women's rights are human rights and human rights are women's rights. You know, when there are humanitarian issues, there are governments, the U.S. government included, that take action swifter. And so why they haven't at this point, you know, is unclear. We do know that right now there is legislation that we are supporting that we would like to be passed called the International Violence Against Women Act. And I would implore anybody who's listening to please, you know, sign our petition for it. Please, there's not a petition. Please reach out to your member of Congress. Make sure that happens.
And what would you like to see short of passage of that International Violence Against Women's Act? What kind of things would you like to see, say, from the State Department to send a strong signal that they're taking these issues seriously?
Well, I would like to see a stronger movement in doing something, that 300 girls who are kidnapped, that there is swifter action, that it doesn't take 3 weeks to even make a statement, that we do something quicker, that we have repercussions with a country that doesn't take action against that. We do that in many other places, and that we have actual rules or actual legislation that is our guidebook when these things happen. Unfortunately, you're absolutely right. Women and girls are not taken as seriously as other human rights issues.
Turning back to the latest in Nigeria, some of the latest reporting I've seen is that the First Lady of Nigeria has called for the arrest of people leading protests against the government over the government's handling of this. How do you respond when you hear something like that?
Leading protests against the government of Nigeria?
Right.
Absolutely. That's what everyone does. We do that here in the United States when we don't think our government is taking quick enough action. We absolutely believe in people taking to the streets and having an outcry, but we need to be standing there with them. We can't leave them by themselves fighting their own government to try to have action. We need, as an international community, to stand by them and to say this is preposterous that these girls can be abducted like this and nothing is done, and that days later more and more girls are abducted.
Lauren, thanks so much for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you very much for having me.
That was Lauren Sapina, Senior Vice President of Women Thrive Worldwide. She joined us to talk about the abductions of young girls in recent weeks in northern Nigeria.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Spring is an active time for birds and animals across Wisconsin, but all the spring activity combined with the brutal winter can leave animals vulnerable. Raptors like hawks and eagles need special care when they're recovering from injury or illness.
Joining us today is Marge Gibson, co-founder of the Wisconsin-based Raptor Education Group, which is dedicated to caring for injured or orphaned native bird species and to public education on wildlife issues. Marge, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So how does someone get into raptor rehabilitation?
Well, I think it's easier now, shall we say, because now there's permits, the permit process is in place. But when I started, it was more of a, you know, an interest. And I always loved birds, even as a little child. And, you know, it just sort of grew from that.
And you do all kinds of different work with the raptors that you're rehabilitating. There are owls and hawks and eagles. What is it like to work with, you know, not just, you know, any bird, but sort of the more majestic and big birds that we have here in Wisconsin?
You know, they're really amazing. And I think the thing that would surprise people is really how intelligent they are. People are always impressed with their majesty and with their presence. But when we're working with them and they're injured, that is very really translated into a calm presence that is actually very cooperative if you know how to handle them. And it really, they're just amazing. And every single one is different. So it, you know, it really is, it's really an honor to work with them.
Can you tell us the story of a bird or two that has been particularly memorable among all that you've worked with over the years?
Oh, boy, there have been so many. We do over 100 eagles a year and over 800 to 1,000 birds a year, so there's been so many. But I think it's the ones that, you know, are pretty tragic beginnings that really stick with us, the ones that have perhaps been poisoned and, you know, have kind of a rough road to hoe for, you know, for months and then actually recover from that poisoning. And we've had several of those. But one that really really sticks with me was a trapping injury. And it was a male bald eagle. It was about 4 years ago. And this bald eagle was trapped inadvertently. It was a trap that was set for a muskrat, and he happened upon it. And it was near the Wisconsin River. And he went into the river with the trap. It fell into the river trying to get it off. And it had kind of a stick attached to it, a last stick that was about 3 feet long. And as he floated down the river trying to stay afloat, the stick would catch up on rocks. And so he was kind of caught up, and then he would get kind of beat up on the rocks. This went on for 3 days. And finally, someone noticed him and called for help. And it happened to be a very, very frigid period here. The ice had just come off, and it was very, very cold as well. So my husband and I were called in an evening, and we drove to the spot that he was at, and some people had found him and had actually gotten him in a box. He was so cold, I really thought he was gone, and they did as well. They, you know, thought we were too late. But when I held him, I could feel that there was, you know, some life left. And I held him in the front seat and, you know, had the heat blowing on him. I brought some heat packs with me to put under his wings because I knew that this was a bird that was going to be cold if he'd been in the water that long. And we drove like the wind back to the Reggie Center and used a hair dryer, you know, to try to dry him.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really in critical condition for about 3 weeks. And the foot was also a problem because it had a trap on it and had been trapped. But when he recovered, he was such a calm bird. It was amazing. He would jump on the side of his box and kind of watch us in the clinic. And our clinic isn't huge. We do a lot of work there, but it's not huge. It's about 20 feet long. And he was just an incredibly observant bird. He recovered.
And did you release him to the wild?
We did. And he was just amazing. He still comes, and he has a nest not too far from us.
Huh.
And he still comes in the spring. In fact, he was here about 2 weeks ago, and then I think now their nesting has started again. And we call him Trapper John, and we don't usually name our patients, but he was sort of special. But, you know, it's those birds that really, really make you realize how incredible they are and the ability that they have to overcome incredible obstacles to survive and then to thrive afterwards.
So he comes back to see you each year?
You know, people always ask us, oh, when you release birds, do they come back? And most of the time, you know, they don't, of course. We release them. They're wild. They go. And this bird was a full adult. He's probably at least 15 years old when he was injured. But there was a special connection. And that happens not infrequently with our patients. But, of course, he's not tame. I mean, you know, a 15-year-old adult bald eagle, I mean, wasn't raised in captivity, nothing. But, you know, I think he knew he was in a lot of trouble. And, you know, there's something interesting that happens. And I can't tell you what it is because it's very hard to put into words. But it's there's definitely a transference that's pretty amazing. And each and every time you work with one of these birds, you really energizes you to continue what you're doing.
This work seems to require specialized training. Do you need to be a qualified veterinarian to do this?
No, in fact, most rehabilitators are not veterinarians. While working a lot with companion animals, domestic animals, are really not trained in wildlife unless it's a specialized specialized course, and there's a few universities that have wildlife veterinary medicine as part of their tract. But wildlife is so different than domestics, and I think it's hard to describe. But for instance, if you know one of our birds would have a bad break and a bad fracture in a wing, if it were a dog or a cat, you know, there would be a simplistic way of fixing it. But birds have hollow bones, and so, you know, to pin it the same way that you would with a mammal really wouldn't work. And, in fact, it often is detrimental to them. So they're very different, but we work with veterinarians. And we're very lucky to have some veterinarians in our area that are wonderful and work with us and learn. But I'm a biologist, and all of my people are either biologists or zoologists. And that's basically what you have. I think that the core is to really understand the biology, the anatomy of the animal, and the natural history. Natural history is so important. If you have a patient, you have to know, a bird patient at least, you have to know when it arrives in the spring, when it leaves in the fall, so you can either release it or not, or actually sometimes we have to transport loons, for instance, down to the Gulf of Mexico.
So you can time it just right.
Yeah. So it's you really have to know their natural history. And it, so it's kind of a combination. And working with them is, and every species is so different. We do over 200 bird species, so they're all different, and you have to know who to put together, that sort of thing, who would be, you know, kind of threatening to each other, and who gets along, and what they eat, you know. I mean, a lot of our birds eat only insects, and that becomes kind of a challenge to feed them as well.
When you're working with these big birds of prey, I mean, they have sharp beaks and talons. These are hunting birds. Is it ever dangerous?
Well, I think it's dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. But I think that, you know, there are many more dog bites, than injuries from wild raptors. And it's the same thing. You know, you really have to know, you have to know the animal, and you have to know, how to handle them. If they're well handled and they don't feel threatened, that really is the key. To being able to handle them.
And we're going to leave it there. But Marge, it's fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing it with us.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Marge Gibson, co-founder of the Raptor Education Group.